this, but recall those of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but those who believe to the saving of the soul.
The topic for this evening has to do with the crisis of faith, taken from the context when Tom just read, especially Hebrews 10:38, where the writer says, but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. So it's an encouragement to not only acquire faith, but also maintain it in this world. Faith is always in crisis. It is true that there are joys of faith, benefits to faith, edification in faith, rewards of faith. It is also true that faith is always in trouble. Not every day brings a crisis. We don't live in a constant state of emergency. But the quality of faith is such that it is always under attack. The carnal mind is one that has no faith at all. It doesn't have to worry about this. I remember Barclay talked about during World War II, because we talked about the terror of the Nazis and their power and how much whatever. But he said, if you were a collaborator, you never felt any of that. You never felt the power of their evil, if you gave in to them. And that's the world around us with a carnal mind. A mind that's always concerned with earthly matters, jobs, sports, family, whatever, and leaves God, the church, the Bible, and faith out of the picture. It's only when you take a stand do you feel the full force of the evil that's in the world. What we'll do in this lesson is look at various crises of faith and how each trial and conflict was handled. First of all, I began with the life of Abraham and the role of faith in his life. We did a pretty good study of this during our look at Genesis, the adult class Sunday morning. The life of Abraham is often held up in New Testament writers as exhibiting the kind of faith that we as Christians should have. Specifically, Romans, Paul gets into it in chapter 4 about how Abraham is the primary example. Although he was a Jew of the Old Testament, his faith is, let me rephrase, he was an individual who was a believer of God in the Old Testament. The term Jew hadn't been established yet, so I couldn't say that. But even for the Jew and for the Christian, he stands as a shining example as someone of proper faith in God. The three major events in Abraham's life, being called out of Chaldea in Genesis 12 and 1, accepting the promise to be in Isaac in Genesis 15, and offering up Isaac in sacrifice, Genesis 22. In each crisis of life, Abraham's faith shines forth. It is no wonder that his reactions to these events remain as examples to us all of the trust in God that we should have. Now, as we talk about this, I can explain it all at this point. A lot of things have to be done in increments, usually small increments. Abraham's faith was such. As you look at Abraham's life, the total, there are times when he seemed to have failed the test, lied through his teeth twice, to get out of trouble. So there are going to be times as one progresses, whether it's growing or whether it's, perhaps they explain this in counseling, that you have to look forward to as you're recovering from something, that it's going to be not a straight line, it's going to be like a sawtooth. There'll be a time when you'll be, you know, making progress, and then you'll lapse. The point is, when you lapse a little bit, use an example of idea of going on a diet. You know, you may go, be fine for a week, and then that chocolate cake in the refrigerator just calls to you. Okay. So you'll have a piece, and you go, oh, man, I can't keep this diet. You don't, you know, drop that and just go, you know, devour the rest of the cake. I've had a setback. I need to start working to come out of it. And so you gradually make progress. You know, that's the way you have to look at it, because that's the reality. And that's the same with Abraham. And the trials that he had to go through were incremental. He didn't have this monumental faith to begin with. He had to be tested. It had to grow. But this is the thing about Abraham. He led it. He made the right decision. In fact, what I brought up in the evangelism class, the big picture, is that as you talk to people, in fact, one of these things I got from sales school, is that as you do a presentation to people, don't make a big presentation at the end expecting them to make a monumental decision. You know, selling insurance, you don't sit down for 45 minutes and then expect them to go, okay, sign this contract and give us a couple $100 a month. You know, it's not going to happen. The presentation has to be such that you have them make small decisions, that they agree with progress so far, so that they can go on to the next step and make progress and agree to that, so that by the time they're at the end of the presentation, the only decision they have to make whether to sign the contract with blue or black ink. And you're not sitting there looking, at each one of them, expecting something to happen, and it's not going to. Same with our faith. It's small, usually, decisions. And it's either a decision to do the right thing or it's a decision to do the wrong thing. It might be small enough, you don't even know what's going on at the time. But it does rely on these little decisions. Little things that you convince yourself up so that when the first big milestone comes or crisis, you either totally lapse or you stand firm. If Abraham had not faith, he would never have left Ur of the Chaldees. Now, do not think of Abraham's original home as a bunch of mud holes in the middle of the desert, and you would have left it in a shot. He lived in the midst of a very thriving civilization. They had surgery on the brain. They knew Pythagorean theorem 1,000 years before Pythagoras came up with it. So their mathematics was incredible. Even before Abraham was born, the area carried on trade down the coast with India. So it was a thriving area. And he lived pretty much in a city of skyscrapers. Multiple ziggurats, towers reaching into the sky. That was his landscape. That's where his friends were, all of his friends, all of his family. You could tell when he left, all the amount of people that depended, that's going to have been a decision itself. When you go, you're going to be the head of this incredible entourage that are all going to be looking to you to support them as you go off into some country you don't even know anything about. So the beginning of the journey took a lot of faith. He would not have, if he didn't have faith, he would not have believed God and stopped trying to make Eleazar the heir. At some point, God had promised him he's going to have an heir. All these, things are going to occur to it, but it ain't happening. And so he's beginning to look like, well, I'm 90 years old or so, and Sarah's past the time of having children. What are we going to do about this? Maybe we'll help God. And was going to make Eleazar, and God had to appear to him and go, no, just hang in there. You will have an heir. Legitimate. So he waited. Okay. Second decision. Third, if he didn't have faith, he would have refused to offer up that boy that finally came. It was supposed to be the promise. And now, the way he understands it anyway, that he's supposed to kill the boy, wouldn't have happened. if by this time he realized there's enough that he had dealings with God that he could trust God implicitly. Many times we don't know when or if a crisis looms. Sometimes just, you know, blindsides us, comes out of the dark, whatever. Sometimes the challenges are great, but other times the situation seems so small that are often overlooked. Notice that in crime dramas, this is the way the innocent party gets sucked in. You know, like, deliver this package for me. Seems innocent, okay. You know, just take the package, put it on the bicycle, take it across town, and give it to somebody. Then be informed afterwards that they just carried an amount of cocaine or counterfeit money or whatever, and now they're involved. You know, do the next thing I tell you or tell the police. You're now an accomplice. It didn't seem like it was a problem. So you realize somewhere along the line you got to get smart. You know, you can't be wandering through life with all its dangers with the blinders on. You know, or like a kid walking down the street with the phones in, you know, completely oblivious to all the traffic zipping by them. Yeah, all the ways they could get hit or shot or whatever. So you know, often it's little tiny situations. Should we watch TV or study our Bibles? No, nothing wrong with watching TV. It depends on the show, but you know, just watching TV. But yeah, perhaps a good study of the Bible. You might get to a point where you go, yeah, 24 hours of Bible study is a little bit much. Maybe I can take a break every once in a while. You know, justifications. But, you know, studying the Bible may give us the information we need to really face the coming crisis. It may not be meeting the crisis at the moment, but it's a preparation for giving us enough information in order to recognize problems when they come. I mean, that's one of the purposes of the Bible. When Paul says we're, you know, concerning Satan, we're not ignorant of his devices. Sometimes it's the kind of friends we pick. You may think it's not a big deal, but do you screen your friends? Or do your parents screen your friends? You should be very much thankful if your parents go, I don't want you playing with that kid anymore. You know, don't trust him, whatever. He'll get you into trouble. Should we stay at home and not attend Bible study? It's a Bible study. I don't know why I go, you know, or singing, whatever. But what influence is that having on us? We've already justified something. We'll always find an excuse to put it off. On what sort of influence will we be to other people? Not only making the wrong decisions for ourselves, but for others as well. They depend on us to make good choices. What if we don't? Depending on children, will they be ready for their crisis if we don't build their faith? To sit down with them, to mentor them on a daily basis. So that when they have spiritual questions, the first thing they think about is, let's go to mom or dad. Abraham probably made 1,000 decisions that related to faith before the 3 tests God put him before. But each decision that led up to the critical one was part of his life of faith. Of his choices. Yeah, you're going to be working through life, making either good choices that build your faith or bad choices that doesn't. I mean, think of it. If you have to go 3 stories up, isn't it easier to go by little steps than to come up to the wall and try to jump the 3 stories? Okay. God's trying to help us with this, a little bit at a time. The decisions that you make each morning about your speech, your work, your worship, your influence, your friends, are all part of the impending crises that will make or break you as a Christian. A daily dose of decisions to make. Hopefully they're all small. But by the time you come to a big one, if it comes, you'll already have made 1,000 good choices leading up to it. And you'll have all the power and strength behind those choices to help you, plus God himself. In the New Testament, you look at the life of Timothy and the role of faith. Although some things like common sense and wisdom cannot be taught, unfortunately, evidently faith can be passed on. Timothy obtained his from his mother and grandmother, according to Paul's writings, 2 Timothy 1:5. This faith of Timothy was needed for the many turning points in his life. He had a mixed background. He was a half-breed, part Greek, part Jew. There was the daily crisis about his training and his schooling, about what he was to believe and accept. The daily activities he had to face as a Greek youngster and the Hellenistic concept of sports, mythology, and idols. That's the world he lived in. They were surrounded by idols. Everybody else was doing it. Why not him? Why not his family? What kind of answer could he give to those when they say, why don't you? You know, burn some incense to this idol or sacrifice your firstborn male to this one or whatever. As to mythology, he had to make the choice. Do you believe in the real stories, the historical accounts in the scriptures, or do you believe in all this made-up stuff of Zeus and Hermes and Heracles and Perseus and all of them? Just stories, fantasy. Which do you believe in? We have the same choices. Do you believe in the reality of God or in all the mythology around us? In sports, oh, what kid doesn't like sports? Unfortunately, sports in the Greek world and the Roman world was carried out in the altogether. The Greek word gymnos means naked. It's the root of our word gymnasium because they worked out without any clothes on. And often, if there were games, they paraded through the streets like that to the workouts, to the events. You might have to back off from the sports. It did not change when he grew up and faced the congregations he was left in charge of, constantly encouraged by Paul to not let them despise his youth. He was well educated. He was well seasoned. Paul left him in charge of an area of souls that Paul was extremely fond and loving of. They were his children. He was willing to leave Timothy in charge of it. He respected the young man that much. And so his advice was, don't let anybody else reject what you are. We can see similar crises in our own lives, in the lives of our children. How much Bible will our children be taught versus secular nonsense? We're inundated with stuff in academia, in the religious world, in politics, and it's all, they really do not have the evidence or the facts to stand on. This is why, as you'll see in the Bible also, they mock. There's no good discussions going on anymore because the liberal mind cannot stand a good, solid discussion of the facts. You want a little comic relief? I'll have the story of the old man who went to see his son in jail. And he goes in and he's looking through the bars and just kind of disgusted on his face, the boy sitting there. And he goes, what did you do this time? The boy goes, nothing. He says, nothing? He locked you up for nothing? He says, listen, all I was doing was discussing politics. And the old man looked at him and goes, what do you know about politics? The boy goes, nothing. That's why I hit him. You're going to get hit in this life because people really don't know what good politics, what good religion, what good morals are. And so they mock to put you down. They got the group. They got the media, the academia, everybody else to mock you Why? Because they can't sit down and have a good, solid discussion with you. Quotation I give you. You know, most of the kids, you like Jurassic Park? You ever read the book? In the acknowledgement in the second book, The Lost World, Michael Crichton, who was a doctor and a pretty good scientist, said this. It remains only to say that nearly all positions on evolution remain strongly contended and fiercely debated. Why? Because there's no facts for it. Yet it's crammed down your throat and you're laughed at for not accepting this pseudoscience. And they think it's funny, or they ridicule you if you say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. But that's the fact. What are you afraid of? How many Bible classes are attended or missed? Depends on your faith. How prepared will they be when it comes the time to choose an occupation, choose a mate? Important one. You know, the world chooses mates how? By the way they look. That wears off really quick if the person that you've chosen is obnoxious. A lot of people who've married pretty people, you know, after a couple of years, will trade that pretty person anytime for somebody with a little bit of character and niceness to them. Especially, you know, what road are they going to lead you down? Are they going to build up the most important thing in your life, your faith in God, the reality of creation and all that? Or are they going to draw you off to other religion or into someplace else in the world? And you will go because you don't want to make them angry. You don't want to upset them. Or as the expression goes, if mama ain't happy, nobody's happy. And so you'll be coerced into making bad decisions and you will lose your faith. Unless you made the proper decision to find out about the person. Are they a good Christian? Are they going to help you in your life to do the right thing and to make the right decisions? Are they going to take the many turns in the road that will lead to being a Christian? Are children capable of doing that? We know that a crisis has been reached many times by the after effect, when it's too late to do anything about it. You know, we hope as teachers and preachers and elders and whatever, as we sit here and talk to you, that you take in the preventive medicine, that you start getting some smarts. But again, as we started off, common sense and wisdom can't be taught. You have to sit there and make the decision to listen and to try to apply it and to see how it fits in, to see if it's the truth or not, and whether you're going to stand for it. You have to do that. Jesus talked about, you know, his audience being dull of hearing. What conjures up in your mind? What does it mean to be dull? Often I know people have talked about how they learned in the first century, or the Jews did, but sometimes we don't relate it to present day. We're very lucky in some ways. Most of you probably have a Bible either in your lap or close to you, or at home anyway. What's it doing there? But they didn't. So what did they do? Someone got up and read from the scriptures. And what did others do? The audience sat there and memorized it. When was the last time you sat there in the audience and you memorized the scripture that was being read to you? Or took it home and memorized it and committed to memory? Committed it to your mind and to your heart? Thought about it? Meditated on it day and night? If not, if you sat there and thought about something else, passed notes, were thinking about the game or whatever was going on, you sat there and you're accused of being dull of hearing. It went in one ear and out the other, and nothing flickered in the eyes in between. children will reach accountability and have no desire to obey the gospel. Children will marry a non-Christian and go with them to another faith or into the world. Children will reach maturity and have no interest at all in God. Why? Because you didn't help them make the little decisions along the way. Congregations in the crisis of faith. Elders, teachers, preachers do not appreciate the need to be instructors of the Word of God. This is probably more for denominational areas where they just have entertainments and puppet shows and whatever. And the sections become rap sessions and social gatherings and whatever, instead of just good old-fashioned Bible studies. People are not aware of the need of the Bible study to prepare for the next issue coming down the road. We're about to be overrun in so many ways. This nation, I get warnings from all sorts of areas. I'm in tune with Sovereign Society. I read Stratford, which is an independent information gathering. It's not CIA, but it's an independent, it's businesses made up of individuals that used to be in the military intelligence gathering, and I kind of use them to keep track of things that are going on all over the world, even in our country. They talk about a financial collapse that's coming in this country. You ready for it? We're being overrun by the Muslims, or the secular attitudes, the progressives, taking over the government, big government itself. The force, it's all sorts of things it's using to slowly eradicate every one of your liberties. You're probably unaware of a lot of things. I talked to a few people that know what's going on, but do you still have Second Amendment rights? Do you even know what the Second Amendment is? Your right to bear arms. The present administration couldn't get that done, to take that away. They tried to go to the UN, and had a resolution passed to have the Second Amendment taken away. Couldn't do it so far. The next best thing is happening. They've used the EPA to shut down the last lead mine in the United States. If you want bullets, you're going to have to buy them from China or Canada. We can't manufacture them anymore. Just a few of the things that are going on. Not to mention all that they're doing to your religious freedoms. Okay. Made a big deal just this last week about, was it Indiana? And their religious laws and stuff like that they passed. Pumped it up in the media. I mean, pumped it up, ridiculed, mocked, whatever. And nobody took the time to find out that 19 other states had already passed the same law and didn't get any flack for it. But they just zeroed out one religious company and decided to crucify them. Could happen to you. People do not want to hear about troubles and issues and problems, thinking that ignoring them will make them go away. An example of isolationism occurred during World War II. Someone to let Hitler and the Imperial Empire fight over Europe and Asia, thinking it would not bother this country. We had two big oceans to protect us. We underestimated the force and the appetite of evil. The result was, instead of being isolated, we ended up fighting a war on two fronts, the European theater of operation and the war in the Pacific. It cost us a lot of good people. Only resistance and war can win over some of these struggles. And really, the best thing you can have is a deep faith in God and a knowledge of how to operate. Some of the isolationists, when it comes to, some are isolationists when it comes to church issues. We are content to let the devil convince us that we have only that he will only bother other churches in a far place and not churches at home. Even now, a lot of the trouble that's happening in the Middle East, the news doesn't pick up the fact that Christians are being targeted. I'll use the Christians, the people that at least claim their faith, but they're strong enough in their faith to die for it. Some believe that preachers are just crying wolf when issues arise and we try to inform them about certain things. Not only new issues coming up, but it's, boy, every 50 years old issues get resurrected and got to be dealt with again. If you'd already studied it, you know, you could recognize it and know what the arguments are. But the devil is real and the danger is present and the faith is in crisis more and more, and many are not even aware of it. Many should now be teachers. That was true in the first century. Are you prepared to be a teacher now? Could you do it? Persecution came on the church in this valley. Could you go like they did in Acts 8 and spread the gospel? Every last one of you? Paul prepared Timothy for crises. 1 Timothy 4:2 and 2 Timothy, the fourth chapter. The Spirit expressly says, in the later times, you know, many will fall away from the faith. That's the first passage, the beginning of that context. Second context, you know, Paul's willing Timothy, you know, be instant, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering. You know, Timothy, you got to be ready for it. It's coming. And it's coming to us too. Are we ready for it? Conclusion. We're out of here. How would you know it without reading God's word to recognize it when it comes? I mean, if you don't know what a moral is or what's right or wrong, how would you know if it's, you know, if it's a problem or not? Most people haven't a clue. An example, when our government says, how do we deal with ISIS? Just find them jobs. How will you know if you are inattentive to gospel preaching? If you don't have a heads up, how are you going to defend the faith that you don't have? Will you be ready when the critical test comes? Will your faith be as strong as Abraham's? Has it made those incremental marches in strength? So the big one can be met as well. One indication is how you respond to the Lord's invitation for your salvation. Every sermon, sometimes in the classes, there's something that says, that tells you all the glories of God, all the magnificent things about the invitation extends, the grace of God, you know, that's prevalent all around us. What kind of world do you live in? Do you go out and see God at work all around you in every facet of life? Or do you just go out and see men's world? I'm kind of blown away sometimes when people go, oh man, yeah, New York is the most beautiful city I've ever seen. It's asphalt, concrete, glass, steel, smells, taxi cabs, you know, but they're used to looking in the world of men. That's what they see. I think we got a better view, you know, out our doors of these magnificent mountains, God's country, snow, trees, clear, you know, clear skies, fresh air, you know, drinkable water. What are the things that God has blessed us with? You know, we are in a good position to be able to appreciate it every day or every night. Did you see the nice big full moon last night? Stars. Nice breeze blowing. I like wind when it's not carrying pollen. Makes you feel alive. A lot of good things in seeing God working in the world. And he continues to work, like we look at this morning. Okay, yeah, you look at the things that men are doing to one another and you get really depressed. But then remember, it's still God is in his heaven and all's right with the world. Whatever's happening, Paul says, we know that God causes all things to work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. We know that. We can see it. Even when other people look at the events going on and go, yeah, the world's about to explode, the apocalypse is on us, dogs are beginning to rap, all that kind of stuff. No, God's making it all work for those that are loyal to Him. They'll come out the other side in this life a lot better off. Or even if it ends up killing them, they're going to be in a far better place, heaven eternal. You can't get the downside of Christianity. There isn't one, either in this life or in eternity. And that invitation God often puts out to us. But do we sit there and just go, I'm dull of hearing. I've got my mind on the world. A short-sighted look at things that are going to pass away very quickly. Or have I got my mind in eternity and have a view of heavenly things? Finally, are you a Christian? Could you meet that critical test? Someone once put it, if you were arrested for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? If they hauled you off to court and said, this is a Christian, and they go, well, he doesn't go to church that much, he doesn't know anything about the Bible, really, you know, he'll back off if you kind of push him a little bit. Is he really a Christian? Or do you have the conviction of your faith to stand up and say, I am a Christian, and I can quote you book, chapter, and verse about any subject you want to cover. And I know what I'm talking about, and I can do it in a way, hopefully, that'll appeal to you. So, the last test of your faith. What decision are you going to make right now to make yourself right with God? Simple decision. Get up, come forward, and let us know what you need. Whether it's waters of baptism or just the prayers of the saints. What is it to be? The invitation is extended. Would you come as we stand to sing?